What's up, everybody? It's Wayne, and this is the Simple Heart Podcast. Or maybe I should say it was the Simple Heart Podcast, because this is going to be the last episode of the pod for a while. And I'll explain why in a bit, but before I go to why, I just want to say thank you. It's been an amazing run. We've had dozens of guests on this podcast, from Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists to Emmy Award-winning musicians to actors to activists to professors. And while the guests have all been super fun and the conversations have been really rewarding to me, to be honest, the most meaningful thing to me about this podcast was talking to a lot of you. I talked to lots of people across the country about how meaningful this podcast was to you, about something you learned, something that inspired you, and that made it meaningful for me. And I'm going to miss it for that reason, because I know a lot of people learned a lot from this podcast. A lot of people became aware of things they weren't aware of, whether it's cryptocurrency or the sociology of social movements, from Doug McAdam to kind of the mass conspiracy to not only disguise what's happening in factory farms, but to crush the people who are trying to expose it. We learned a lot of things together. And it's been quite a fabulous run. And I thought for this, you know, last or at least last podcast in a while episode, where I talk directly to all of you and share some of the things I've learned from the, how many podcasts is it? 40-something, 50-something? Someone should count. I don't even know how many conversations it's been. But I've learned a lot of things, and one of the hard things about stopping now is that I feel like I've gotten a lot better at it. And I've learned how to talk to people, how to listen to people in a way that, even after I just blogged about how I've had 100,000 conversations about animal rights in the last 20 years, probably more than 100,000 conversations, but it's a lot. It's a lot. But even after all these conversations on the street, there's something very distinct about podcasting, about sitting down with someone face to face, eye to eye, and going deep and going personal. You know, I mean, I had so many unexpected conversations where, for example, I was meaning to talk to Glenn Greenwald, the Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, about exposing the secrets of the US government, about trying to defend his friend Edward Snowden from extradition and arrest in the United States for exposing the US government's own criminal conduct. That's what I thought I was going to talk to him about. But instead, we winded that conversation down into a story of a little kid growing up in Florida and afraid to let his family know, even his progressive socialist family, know that he was gay. And I understood so much more about Glenn as a result of that conversation. And partly because I understood a little more about Glenn, I also understood a little more about the world. And yeah, I wanted to share just a few lessons that I've learned from these conversations that have gone deep, that have gone personal, that have gone in directions that I wasn't really expecting them to go. And maybe the first one is that listening is an absolutely crucial skill, but it is a skill and not a state. I think a lot of people think listening is just something you do or don't do, right? It's just kind of a state that you're in. You're either listening or you're talking. You might be listening at a different level. You know, sometimes you're listening closely, sometimes you're listening not so closely, but it's mostly a physical or even auditory phenomenon. And one of the things I think I've learned very deeply from all these conversations is that listening is not a state. It's not even really an action. It's a skill, meaning you have to develop the skill. You've got to practice. You've got to take feedback on it and get better. And let me explain what I mean by that. Most conversations we have in the world happen at a very surface level. You know, I mean, the classic example, this is small talk. How are you doing? I'm doing fine. And no one's really actually paying attention. But even when you are paying attention to someone, usually all you're trying to do is comprehend and analyze their words, right? So, you know, I had a conversation with Helena Merck, a buddy of mine who lives very close to me and is part of the same gym, Orange Theory, about cryptocurrency. And a lot of what I had to do in listening to her and having that podcast conversation was analyze what she was saying, because she was talking about a lot of stuff that you and I and many other people just could not fathom. Really complicated technology, coding, acronyms that probably didn't make sense to you and certainly didn't make sense to me. But analysis is only the first step of good listening. Truly good listening doesn't just analyze what someone is saying. Truly good listening embraces the feeling of what's said. It's kind of like the Vulcan mind meld. And I say this despite actually not knowing a lot about Vulcans or about Star Trek. But what I understand about the Vulcan mind meld is when a Vulcan melds with your mind, they literally feel what you're feeling. And one of the most powerful things, and I'd say the most powerful thing about listening, is when you're listening so intently, where you've kind of been able to dissolve away your own consciousness and your all the noise in your own head, all the voices and anxieties and stressors, and even kind of when you're thinking about a podcast and you're hosting a podcast, thinking about, oh, am I doing a good job with this podcast? You even do away with that. You're not thinking about the podcast anymore. You're just completely absorbed in not just the words of the person you're talking to, but the feelings they're expressing too. And there are powerful moments like this. And it actually, in a weird way, reminds me of meditating. When you're meditating and you reach this peak level of meditation and consciousness, your own subjectivity, your own feelings sort of dissolve away and you just feel connected in this really spiritual, powerful way. And I say this as someone who's an atheist. You know, I don't mean there's any metaphysical nature to this, although there could be. You know, I've got good friends like Priya who would say this is a metaphysical reality. But there's almost this spiritual connection when you're meditating to all the other consciousness of the world when you reach peak meditation. And the same is true when you're listening. There's this deep spiritual connection. You just start feeling what the other person is feeling. So, you know, when I talked to Priya about the optimism she felt about the trial, you know, I could feel it. I could feel that she felt very confident that we're going to come back. But I also could feel there was like a sliver of doubt. There was a sliver of possible despair and the idea that, you know, one of her best friends and the father to her non-human children, because we co-parent, you know, Oliver and Joan, was not going to come home for a long, long time. And, you know, it's obviously easy to do with somebody like Priya. I can feel her feelings, and it's one of the reasons she's so dear to me, and we've had such a great relationship, even though we've gone through a lot of ups and downs, and we had a very difficult breakup many years ago. But because we have this capacity to listen to each other and really feel each other's feelings. But what's more unique is when you develop that capacity with strangers, and it's hard, and sometimes strangers are closed off. I will say, one of the best podcasts I had, in fact, it was the first podcast, was with Ezra Klein. Ezra Klein is a New York Times columnist, the founder of Vox, a dedicated animal advocate, amazing guy, so brilliant and smart. And it was a very good podcast in the sense that I got to ask Ezra really great questions and he gave really fucking great answers because it's Ezra Klein. Of course he's going to give great answers. He's so fucking smart. And he has all these really amazing thoughts on animal rights that are worth listening to. And I encourage you to go back and listen to that podcast. But interestingly, even though Ezra is one of the most famous journalists in the world, he's a New York Times columnist, and even though he had really compelling things to say, I didn't really get that much great feedback from that podcast. And part of the reason for that, I think, is because I was not able to feel what Ezra was feeling. And I'm not sure he was letting me, you know, because Ezra is an extremely analytical person. And I still remember, I listen to his podcast. I'm a little bit of a fanboy. So hopefully Ezra's not listening to this podcast because he's going to find out how much of a fanboy I am of him. But I listened to his podcast with Ta-Nehisi Coates, who Ta-Nehisi Coates, for those of you who don't know, is an amazing journalist and author. He's done all sorts of cool stuff. You know, he did a run with Black Panther. You know, he's a comic book writer for a while. He's been a journalist. He's written some of the most important books on civil rights in the last 10, 15 years. I think he's been really leading the charge on movements like Black Lives Matter and elevating the concerns that a lot of people of color have in this country. And, you know, he's probably most famous for a book called The Case for Reparations. You might be someone who on a knee-jerk level doesn't like the idea of reparations. I encourage you to read the book. And there's an article in The Atlantic with the same subject. And it's actually a very sober, thoughtful, but also empathetic book. It's a sympathetic book. But I'm getting beside the point. I remember when Ta-Nehisi Coates was on Ezra Klein's podcast, one of the things he said about Ezra that I just loved. I loved what he said. He didn't say this about Ezra. He said this about Ezra's book. why we're polarized. He said, you know, Ezra, you write about really important things that involve so much suffering and joy. And also conflict and intensity and anger and hate, because why we're polarized is about why we're polarized, why we're fighting with each other. And he says, this is such an emotionally loaded subject, right? Why we're polarized. I mean, literally, polarization and emotion go hand in hand. And I'm surprised because this is a cold atheist book. I remember that line and I loved it so much. I was like, that's so true. All of Ezra's work is, it's like cold atheist work. And that conversation I had with Ezra was a cold atheist conversation. And again, I'm not saying there isn't a place for that. There isn't a place for that. There is a place for that. And Ezra's podcast is, you know, one of the best in the world. I listen to it all the time. But for what I was trying to do, which wasn't just to inform people, but to inspire and persuade people, it's not enough to have cold atheist conversations. You need to have conversations that feel, right? Hot spiritual conversations. Sorry, that sounds a little weird. I promise this isn't some weird kinky thing. No, there are enough allegations about me out there. So I'm telling you right now, Shiloh's going to edit this. And don't edit that out, Shiloh, because I like including my mistakes and, you know, the dumb things I say. Partly because of the second lesson from doing this podcast, which is about authenticity. But the point I want to make here is that listening so you feel is a skill and not a state. And sometimes it's hard. You know, sometimes people are closed off from it. But not just in podcasts, but in every day, I think all of us should challenge ourselves to listen so we feel. Not just listen so we comprehend, but listen so we feel. In over and over again, the best interactions I have, the most transformative experiences I have with other people and with non-human people as well, are when I'm listening in a way that allows me to feel. And one of the beautiful things about this is you can listen to animals in a way. And I mean non-human animals, obviously, not human animals, because humans are animals too. But there is a way to listen to even non-human animals in a way that makes you feel. I was actually just doing that a few moments ago with my cat, who's quite ill. He's blind. He's probably going to pass away. There's urine in his blood. I have to give him enemas every couple of days, give him fluids every couple of days. It's been quite an arduous journey, but it's also been incredibly beautiful because every time I hear him crying, even when he's suffering, I feel it, and I feel it very, very deeply. So that's lesson one from podcasting. Listening is a skill, not a state. You need to listen so you can feel. Second lesson, and I suggested this already just a moment ago, but the second lesson is authenticity is as hard as it is powerful. Let me just say that again. Authenticity is as hard as it is powerful. When I first started doing podcasts and listening to podcasts, I started listening to the number one podcast in the world, which is the Joe Rogan podcast. And honestly, I was a little puzzled. I was like, why do people like this? I didn't think, you know, the educational content was particularly high. I mean, he has a lot of comedians and like MMA fighters on. There's a lot of conspiracy theories on it. I disagree with so much about what he says. You know, he's very anti-vegan. He's a hunter. He's always trashing veganism, which hopefully all of you know. I'm a great believer in veganism. I love it. Contrary to popular belief, I am not anti-vegan, even though I did write the article Boycott Veganism. Much to my great shame, I did write that article. Please don't Google it. You know, what's the point of saying please don't Google something? Whenever you say to anyone, please don't Google something, they go and Google it. So you're probably going to Google Boycott Veganism. You're probably going to hate me if you're vegan. I'm just kidding. Hopefully you don't hate me. But I will say, if you do Google Boycott Veganism, read the entire article. I'm not even sure it's available online anymore. If it's not available, good. But if it is available, read the entire thing. Read the entire thing before you condemn me as anti-vegan. But I got on a little digression. What I learned from listening to just a few episodes of the Joe Rogan podcast and comparing it to a lot of the other content out there, whether it's movies, TV shows, you know, interview shows, is that the podcast feels very real. And that's one of the reasons it's become so powerful and really, you know, changed the course of American culture in important ways, with I think tens of millions of people listening to it every week, because it feels real. In a world that's filled with performance, I mean, that's literally what social media is. That's what all these corporations are doing. Everything around us is performance. there's something really powerful about authenticity, but authenticity is also getting harder, partly because we all feel not just the desire, but we feel almost the compulsion, you know, the massive social pressure to perform. And the reason is, well, the social media and the internet have been great things. You know, every one of us now has a megaphone to the world. That also means every one of us is potentially scrutinized by the world. And that's a double-edged sword, right? It allows us to do a lot of good things. You know, it used to be the case that an animal rights activist like me would never be able to reach millions of people. And I have. Not only have I reached millions of people, I've reached millions of people many times with investigations and live streams and videos that have gone viral. But the double-edged sword of that is millions of people can also watch me. And any of us who've ever had any sort of performance anxiety, you know, and I do have, even me, I mean, sometimes I still have performance anxiety. Felt like, for example, I had performance anxiety in Utah recently when we went to trial. I didn't think I was being my authentic self and in a way that was as powerful as it could have been. But when you know millions of people are potentially watching you, or frankly, even when you know one or two people who are strangers are watching you, our natural reaction is to perform, is to do things that are not who we actually are, to say things that we don't actually believe. And I think that's dangerous, and I think it also makes us weak. And those two things are related. Part of the reason it's dangerous is it does make us weak. Because when we perform, we can't raise our independent perspective. We can't raise independent concerns. We can't present independent facts. And we just go along with the crowd, right? And we all blend into one totally meaningless blob of nothingness. But when we're authentic, we try to be real and we try to be fully three-dimensional and just try to show who we actually are and instead of what we think people want us to say or do or think, then it's incredibly powerful. And the best conversations, the conversations that have been the most meaningful on this podcast have been the ones that felt real. And I'll just give you some examples. I mean, I had a couple pods with my buddy Matt Johnson, you know, where I was getting genuinely angry and then genuinely almost tearful, where his ex-girlfriend, Kesia, was sharing some real shit about their relationship dynamics and how hard it was to organize with someone that she loved, and then they had a breakup, you know? But it wasn't just the personal stuff that was real. I mean, having real conversations with academics about just their insecurities and doubts. So one of my least favorite podcasts that I did, which actually, you know, got some good reviews, but it's just painfully difficult for me to listen to, is the conversation I have with Duncan Watts. Because Duncan, as you'll hear if you listen to the podcast, is the author of the most cited paper in the history of sociology. And I'm completely fanboying through the entire conversation. It's almost embarrassing, and I hate listening to it for that reason. But it's still a good conversation because one of the things that I was able to achieve and that Duncan was able to achieve in that conversation is admitting that he just didn't know the answers to a lot of questions. Here you've got a trained physicist and sociologist who has mountains of data far beyond what any of us can possibly even comprehend, who has the most advanced statistical and mathematical and scientific tools to understand that data, to understand what works and why, how you actually create change. And honestly, most of that podcast was Duncan sort of struggling to figure out how things work and why they work when they do work. And that was cool. That was cool. I think there needs to be more of that in this world. There needs to be more authenticity, more people just being real, including admitting they don't know the answer. And I'd like to see a little bit more of that in the world. And I learned that in this podcast, that admitting you don't know what the answer is can be incredibly powerful because it builds trust in the people you're talking to, and in this case, hopefully in your audience too. So that's lesson two. Authenticity is as hard as it is powerful. And so we got to try to make it happen. Third lesson. Passion is rare, but transformative. This is actually something I've noticed in all the podcasts I listen to. And really, it's something that you're seeing in social media. And I, you know, a lot of it is kind of bullshit passion, just like the Jake Paul, Logan Paul types jumping up and screaming at somebody and getting into fights or whatever it is, and just all sorts of ridiculous hijinks. And so let me caveat this and say the passion has to be real. It has to be authentic. But real passion is as rare as it is transformative. And what I've found is that the podcast that had the biggest impact on me and the biggest impact on the people listening to this podcast were the ones where I and the person I'm talking to were both incredibly passionate about what we were saying. And there's something really important about that, because we're living in an era of cynicism. You know, most people have this almost casual despair about the world. The world's falling apart. Nothing works. Everything's fake. Everything's stupid. And so when you meet someone who is genuinely, genuinely passionate about something, it feels like you've just run into a unicorn, right? And one of the amazing things is that despite all the cynicism and despair and distrust and boredom in the world, people still do have real passions. They have passions for the people they love, their dogs, their cats, their loved ones, their family members, their wives, their husbands, their partners. They have passion for causes like animal rights or climate change. They have passion for art, you know, music, paintings, poetry. And they have passion for ideas, academics who are just so invested in their research that you can hear it in their voice. You can see it in the twinkle in their eyes, that there's just something really beautiful and deep and real and intense about the things they do, the things they work on, the things they believe. And I guess one of the things I learned is not only do we need to find our passions, but we need to cultivate in each other. Because right now we're living in an era of amusement. I think, you know, amusement is kind of the sign of our times. There's TikTok, there's Facebook, there's all this dumb stuff on Netflix we can watch. There's delicious food that can amuse us on every street corner, fast food, even vegan junk food. I mean, like, I live within a few minutes of a place that has vegan shakes, vegan burgers, vegan fries, you name it, there's vegan everything. So even vegans, you know, dour, serious, unpleasant vegans, all these things to amuse us, just amuse our taste buds. But that's not passion, because passion has some purpose beyond just immediate pleasure. And when you see and feel and hear something that has real passion, the way I feel about my dog Lisa, for example, who died last year in October, every time I've talked about her, every time I've written about her, you can see and feel and hear the passion in my voice, because what we had together, me and Lisa, was real. And I think we need to find more of that. Okay, so I've gone on and on, and I actually wasn't planning to make this conversation that long, because Shalo said, just record something real quick to explain to people why the podcast is pausing. And I know I haven't gotten to that point, so I will ultimately explain why the podcast is pausing or ending in a bit. But the last lesson I wanted to share is something that I've learned very, very deeply, and that I'm still working on and trying to get better about, because I haven't always embrace this lesson as much as I should have. And talking to people over the last year and a half and doing this podcast has taught me this lesson very, very vividly, is just this: relationships matter. I don't mean romantic relationships. I don't even necessarily mean relationships between two individuals. Sometimes a relationship can be between a person and a community, between a community and an ecosystem. But when I started doing activism, and when I started Direct Action Everywhere, the grassroots animal rights network I'm most known for, I really thought the atom of the social movement and really the atom of the Earth's ecosystems was the individual. That when we think about good or bad or change or stasis, the relevant thing for us to think about was kind of what was between, I'm pointing at my head right now, so you can't see this, but what's between these two fingers, like this brain, this consciousness, this whatever you think it is that's within an individual, whether it's an individual human being or an individual animal. And I think partly from having these conversations and realizing, you know, among other things, how important friendships were to the civil rights movement, that if you had a single friend who's part of the civil rights movement, your likelihood of engaging in high-risk activism increased by 80%, 80%, you know, by hearing stories from Doug McAdam about how even in the face of all the lynchings and violence and repression of the 1950s and 60s, black people in the United States became more and more optimistic, more willing to fight for change, which is amazing. Because you'd think, like, when your friends are literally being murdered on the streets, when your friends are being thrown in jail merely for sitting in the wrong seat on a bus, merely for sitting down at a cafeteria and asking, can you serve me too? For trying to go to a school and get an education. When people are being killed and imprisoned for those basic acts of human dignity and respect and meaning, you'd think that people would be cynical and angry and filled with despair, but they had more hope. And the reason was they had powerful relationships with each other and with their communities that drove them to greater heights. And I still remember the story that Doug told me about how in the 1960s, if you look at survey data and you ask people in the black community, how optimistic are you about the future? And they got more and more optimistic. It's like almost like the more people got arrested, the more people got killed, the more optimistic we get. And he said the reason is, even when all that was happening, you still had people gathering around television sets and watching things like Joe Louis becoming the heavyweight champion of the world, the first black man to become heavyweight champion of the world. And they came together, they cried, they laughed, they cheered, and they had a relationship to each other, to their community, and to their shared future. And that's something I just didn't really understand. I mean, I was working in an individualistic, atomistic way. And it's weird because I realized as long ago as 2007, when I wrote this article called Boycott Veganism, that individual consumer change didn't work. I knew that it's not enough just to get people to buy and sell a different set of products. We've got to change people's minds, their hearts, the social norms, the systems, the institutions, the policies. But even when I was focused on these bigger systemic structures, I thought that the pathway to changing those structures was by looking at each individual's brain, their beliefs, their behaviors, their desires. And I no longer think that. And a big part of the reason is the conversations I've had over the last couple of years, because I've realized that when we have succeeded, and by we, I don't just mean animal rights activists, although that's the movement I'm most known for. By we, I mean the human species. When we have succeeded in overcoming racism, sexism, huge cataclysmic environmental problems, you know, like climate change, when we've succeeded and made progress on these issues, it's because we've understood and we have developed and healed and restored our relationships. We haven't just focused on each of our individual needs. What does this mean? It means a lot of things. And I think it's one of the primary reasons that my activism has shifted so much over the last few years. I ran for mayor. I started thinking more about my personal life and having a more balanced personal life. because I think that you can't be a good leader if you don't have real and genuine relationships as a foundation and anchor. I spent a lot more time with my family. My dad, who's, you know, diabetic and had some health issues. My sister, who's, you know, gone through some family struggles. My cousin, who's gone through a lot of struggles in San Francisco. I spent more time with them. I spent a lot more time with non-human family members, too. I really cherished, even though I didn't know she was going to go, I cherished the fact that Lisa was back in my life in October of last year. She came back into my life full-time, you know, because for a while she was splitting time with Priya, and for a while before that she was actually only with Priya, and I've just come visit them. But they came back to my life because I was going to trial in December of 2021, and you know, Priya and I decided like it should be my time to be with these animals, because you know, I thought at the time that if I went to prison I'd never see Lisa again. Little did I know that I wouldn't go to prison, but I'd never see her again, because she'd pass away from a heart attack in October of 2021. But there was something incredibly powerful about just spending that time with my dogs, my family, and thinking harder about how relationships serve as the foundation for everything we do. They inspire us to fight for more. They inspire us to think about the connections between the actions I take, even the beliefs that I have, and the impacts those actions and beliefs have on the people around me. Without those relationships, not only would I not be able to achieve the things that I think need to be achieved systemically, because systems are at root not just about individuals working as little atoms and little silos, all, you know, doing the same things or different things for that matter. It's not just about these individuals and their little silos. It's about the connections between each other and about understanding how those connections can change the world or cause cataclysmic crises in the world. I have a lot more to say and write and think about this, because I'm really just beginning to understand what that matters, or what that really means, and why that matters, and how I can implement that into my personal life and in my activism. But as I said, this has gone on and on. So, and I promised you all that I'd explain why I'm pausing the podcast. And the reason is the right to rescue is hitting the road. We won in a very important court case in October of 2022, a historic court case for the right to rescue against the largest pig farm in the nation. And I've gotten so many inquiries and requests and questions from people, lawyers, law students, and just random citizens and journalists who are wondering how we won. And I don't necessarily have all the answers. I mean, we're going to have this summit on January 13th to 15th at the University of Denver, where we'll answer some of these questions together. What I do know is if we are going to defend the right to rescue, and we're going to build a true movement for rescue, and I still think that rescue is not just the defining action of the animal rights movement, it's the defining action of the human species. This is who we were meant to be. We were meant to be caretakers, not tormentors of this earth. I really do believe that. But to get there, to build not just a movement, but a world grounded in rescue and the idea that when others are suffering and vulnerable, we should give them aid, not kick them while they're down, not slaughter them, not torture them even more when they're already suffering so much, but to rescue the other living beings of this earth and to expect rescue ourselves, or when we are in tough moments ourselves. To do that, I need to focus on that more. I need to do more trainings and writing, more legal work. And so many of you know I've got two right to rescue trials myself coming up in the next year. One in Dane County, Wisconsin, involving an open rescue at one of the two largest beagle research and breeding facilities in the nation. Another in Sonoma County, California, at the largest organic poultry producer in the nation, Purdue Foods. But I'll be taking on two other trials as counsel, just as a lawyer, in the next few weeks. Or I should say we're planning to. There could be some obstacles, and it's possible the industry will try and stop me from being involved in these cases. And there's still a lot of logistical and bureaucratic and legal obstacles for us to overcome. But I think I've developed an understanding of how to win these cases. And by win these cases, I don't even mean necessarily get an acquittal, a not guilty verdict in a court of law. What I mean is just help ordinary people all over the nation and the world understand why rescue is the defining action of our species, why we need to give aid to these beings who desperately need us, and how good it is for us, how redemptive it is for us as a species and as individuals, because there's no feeling in the world better than giving aid to someone who desperately needs it. So that's what I'm going to try and do. And that means, you know, the podcast, which has gone in so many different directions, but, you know, primarily isn't focused on rescue, is it's going to have to pause so I can litigate these cases. I can do this storytelling. And concretely, you know, there are three things that I'm really focused on in the next few months and years. One is strategic impact litigation. I'll be a lawyer and consultant and counselor and advisor in criminal cases and civil cases across the country and world involving activists giving aid to sick and dying animals. Two is storytelling. I want to get much more involved in video production. And, you know, many of you have probably heard that I don't like TikTok. I don't like the 1-minute videos. I think there's still space for them, though. It's the only way to engage people. My hope is we can continue to create long form content like the blog, which I'm going to continue doing, because there's something really important about the written format for clarifying my thinking. But we're going to use video production to get people into long form content, whether it's the blog or longer form videos, 10, 15 minute videos that dive deeper into subjects. So that's second, storytelling. And third is training. You know, I just did my first open rescue workshop in many years. It was a great experience. And I've learned so much from these trials that I'd like to teach the world. And in turn, be taught by the world after people hear these stories. Because there's so many people like you probably who have important insights that I want to pick something up from. But I can't do that if I'm just having random conversations and podcasts of people all over the map. I need to narrow my work and my focus down into what I think is, again, the defining action of not just the animal rights movement, but of the human species, rescue. So that's what I'm going to do. So I'll just conclude by again saying thank you to all the people who have devoted so much time and effort to this podcast. Shalil Lafakis for editing, Priya Sohani, Julie Waldrop, Ronnie Rose, my co-executive producer, Dean Merzakowski, Louis Bernier has helped out on some podcasts. Crystal Heath has helped out with a lot of podcasts. Catherine Binns in Florida has been an amazing consultant. Celeste Esser has helped us with some transcripts. I'm trying to think of other people who have helped out. I'm sure there are other people I'm not even remembering who have done so much to bring the green pill and then Everybody Wayne Shung tonight and then the Simple Heart podcast to life. But as you might guess, the last people I want to thank or the last person I want to thank is you. Thanks for listening. There have been thousands and thousands of people listening to this podcast over the last year and a half. It's been quite a run. It's possible we'll record some other episodes. It'll be much more ad hoc, you know, probably once every couple months, only when there's something that just comes up that is such an interesting conversation that I just feel like I'm compelled to publish it to the world. But don't expect this podcast to happen regularly right now and for the next few months, because I'll be busy fighting for the right to rescue. But in that fight and in the journey we've taken on this podcast, the thing that inspires me most is you. Knowing that there's so many people out there just like you, listening in, providing support, making change in your own lives, in small ways and large. And I'm just really grateful. I'm grateful to you. Stay tuned for more. I'm probably going to be traveling quite a bit to represent activists in these cases. Please subscribe to the blog, simpleheart.substack.com. Go to the blog right now and subscribe so we can stay in touch. I'm still going to be blogging probably once a week, maybe twice sometimes, but mostly once a week on Thursdays. Follow me on social media because you're going to probably see some more video production from us as we shift a little away from podcast and a little towards video and a little away from general content about cryptocurrency and climate change and homelessness towards content that's more focused on just rescue. But whatever happens, I'm, again, just grateful and excited to stay connected to you. So thanks. Until next time.